Chris Hewitt, and welcome to The Ranking. This is the latest edition of the show that sees four Empire writers argue the toss about a particular series of films and then put them in definitive order. Ooh, well, according to us, empirical order, if you will. This episode will be arguing the toss by one of cinema's greatest stylists, Brian De Palma, for It Is He. And joining me around this table, dressed to kill for this big blowout celebration of all things Bri-Bri, are Ian Freer, shaking his head. Have you never called him Bri-Bri?
No. I think he's the world's greatest Brian.
Is he?
There's not a greater Brian than Brian De Palma.
Brian Adams begs to differ.
I spelled differently, though. Brian Dean?
I'm not talking about the musicians. This guy called Brian Adams.
Brian Dean, the Sheffield United forward, is he?
Yeah. Brian Dean of Sheffield United.
Yeah, maybe.
Brian May?
Henson.
Brian Henson?
All right, he's the fourth best one.
Yeah,
I'll give up.
He's rapidly falling down the ladder of good Brians. All right, so that's Ian Freer. Next up, we have Johnny Pyle.
Hello, mate.
How are you?
Feeling woefully underprepared.
Why? You've only seen six Brian De Palma films.
Well, I got to 10 for my top 10, but otherwise I'm really struggling, which is my only excuse of having Mission to Mars in a top 10 anywhere.
Yeah,
he's made a lot of films. He's been busy.
He has been busy, hasn't he? He's been putting in the hours over the last few years. And the voice you've heard a couple of times now is Nick Desemlian, who is a big De Palma fan as well.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
Ish. Yeah, Ian's making faces. I'm not as big a Brian De Palma fan as Ian is.
Well,
Ian has seen the early non-funny ones.
The early non-funny ones.
With Robert De Niro.
Yes. Yeah.
Back when he was known as Bri Bri.
I've only seen the one with Robert De Niro where he's got a baseball bat.
And enthusiasms.
But I do love what I've seen.
Okay, that's good.
I've seen all of them.
That's good. And this is a very, very small room, so if any of you start walking around behind me with a baseball bat, then I know exactly what you were up to. But first up, De Palma himself, Ian. When did you first get turned on to Bri-Bri?
Well, if anyone's listened to the Scorsese podcast, you'll remember I read a book called The Movie Brats, which is the book that coined that phrase.
Yes.
And that's Spielberg, Lucas, John Milius, Francis Coppola, Scorsese, and Brian De Palma.
Mm-hmm.
So I got turned on to him by that book, and the first one I saw was Carrie, which is out now on Blu-ray and DVD.
Price just £16.99.
You were selling them just outside this room earlier on.
And it's amazing, Carrie. It's so 70s, but it still hasn't dated. You can still watch it now and think it's so great. It's brilliant. So I saw that, then I went and watched everything. And I was lucky at the late 80s at the BFI, there was a screening of everything he'd ever done up to that point. So I saw a lot of the kind of obscure ones that it's very hard to see nowadays. Like
Untouchables.
The Untouchables, Mission Impossible, the Wedding Party, Murder à la Mode, and kind of really obscure ones.
Fantastic. So you're a completist?
Pretty much.
When's your book, The Complete De Palma, coming out?
Exactly, yeah. I even like the Dancing in the Dark video.
What's not to like about the Dancing in the Dark video?
Oh, Courtney Cox.
Oh, come on. What? Come on. She's good. She's fine. In fact, if we were allowing music videos, I'd probably put it in my top 10. Or the De Palma documentary by Noah Baumbach.
Back and Jack Kasdan, yeah.
Yeah, stick it in.
Definitely my favourite De Palma film, yeah.
Johnny, when was your first experience of the man that everybody calls Bri Bri?
Was it Friday?
No, it was 2 decades ago.
It was a Friday.
As Nick says to me, it's Mission Impossible, and Nick said, you know, that's not really understanding what Brian De Palma's all about if you choose Mission Impossible as a good Brian De Palma film. Which I don't think that is very fair.
It's
Nick.
On my list. Hang on, I never said this.
You said this on Friday to me when I said
no,
you
I
like,
changed my mind. It's on my list.
Well, that's a real about turn, isn't it?
Yeah.
Given that we came to blows.
Much like a character in Mission Impossible, I've betrayed you. And I've brought not the knock list, I have the Nick list.
So yeah, the answer is Mission Impossible, which, as Nick says, and is sticking by it, even though he claims not now, is not really a true De Palma film. So I didn't really discover De Palma that way. I've discovered, I think, De Palma through The Untouchables and then Carrie, which you just catch on late night Channel 4.
Yeah.
You know, in the late 90s. And without really understanding that what Brian De Palma was, I mean, the Brian De Palma that I knew most of all was the guy who hated Star Wars on the first screening. So you immediately come into this guy. This guy does nothing. But then gradually over the years, you pick up that, you know, he might know a few things.
The crawl was his idea, wasn't it?
It is, yeah.
There we go. Thank you, Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
Cheers, Bri-Bri.
Yeah.
See, everyone calls him Bri-Bri.
Very famously took the Mickey out of the Force.
Right.
The Force was ridiculous.
I wonder what he thinks of midichlorians.
Because the man who made The Fury, sorry, it's like,
The Fury.
He's not in a strong position to tell anyone what's ridiculous or ludicrous. Some of the stuff in his films is bare bonkers.
I mean, presumably he likes midichlorians, right? Because they add a scientific reasoning to the Force, which is presumably why he didn't like the first time. It's too mystical and like unknowable. But now midichlorians, science.
Yeah.
Probably true.
That's exactly what the midichlorians are. They are pure science. Nick, your first experience...
I don't know. I can't remember the first, but I remember seeing Scarface when I was pretty young at school. There was a guy called Steve who had Scarface on VHS and Aliens on VHS. And so we used to, when the teachers weren't about, watch those. And I was very impressed by Scarface. I know it's not generally beloved by people, but it made a very strong impression on me.
Is that the case? Is it
surprisingly,
not generally beloved?
It's rubbish. As I learned, because I did a big kind of oral history piece on it a few years back, and... Yeah, a lot of people were, like, unenthusiastic about the fact I was writing a big article.
Really?
Yeah.
I see, I think that film's... I thought, for me, that film's always been thought of as a classic.
I think the fact it's become kind of beloved by rappers and footballers, I think now it has kind of acquired a reputation as a kind of a sort of dumb film that, you know, hasn't got much to it. That seems to be the general impression. Yeah. I don't think it's been embraced as a classic, particularly.
The poster is better than the film.
Oh, that's not true.
The oral history is better than the film.
The oral history is great. So,
thanks, Johnny.
Nick, you got to speak to De Palma, didn't you?
I did, via Skype. And every time I go on Skype, I get very excited because Brian De Palma's little profile pops up. He has a fake name, which I won't say. But
It Ryan De Palma?
It's Ryan De Palma. Yeah.
No one's ever going to crack that code.
It's at BriBri43.
BriBri, the De Palmerizer.
So I get very excited when I go on Skype because it's Brian De Palma, Brian Thompson from The X-Files, the alien bounty hunter.
Wow.
Those two guys pop up.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But I haven't sort of called him in the middle of the night or anything.
No, that would be bad. That would be very bad. Do you guys, I know this is maybe going off the beaten path slightly, but do you have any famous Skype contacts who are on there whenever you open it up?
No, I haven't, no.
You know what Skype
is,
Ian?
I've got Larry Cuba. Larry Cuba is the man who created the Death Star plans.
See, that's good.
That's the pretty only good. One I've got. That's pretty good. I've got Gothmog as well. I got quite a few orcs.
Really?
From Lord of the Rings. And so Gothmog pops up there.
I have Ariana Richards.
That's pretty
Jurassic
good.
Park.
That's good.
But she's my only Skype contact because I downloaded Skype to speak to her. For you, Nick.
I don't have Skype. What the hell? Okay, must have deleted it.
No one needs Skype these days.
I think
everyone has FaceTime.
Skype is still important. Ian, have you interviewed De Palma in your time?
No, I saw him being interviewed on stage at the BFI in the late 80s.
Right.
But I've never
It's
never
not
met
the same
him.
Thing.
It's not the same thing, no.
How was he?
He's very good, yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, the documentary is brilliant.
Yes, it is.
The De Palma documentary. You haven't seen that. So the documentary is Noah Baumbach and Jake Paltrow, and they got together and they basically went to De Palma's house and they just recorded them talking for ages about his movies. And that may sound not great. It's just a old bloke talking about his films, but it's fantastic.
My favourite thing about that documentary is the fact he keeps saying holy mackerel. That's his kind of catchphrase, which I guess is... He keeps reminding me of Robin from 60s Batman.
Yeah. Holy mackerel.
Holy mackerel.
So my first experience of De Palma, I can't remember exactly the first time that I saw a De Palma film, but I do remember experiences of watching De Palma films and just being astonished by his set pieces. Because I called him one of Hollywood's great visual stylists at the beginning. And he is, and obviously he owes a big debt to Hitchcock, and we'll get on to that in a few minutes. But for me, there is something bravura about a lot of the set pieces and the attempts, whether it's Mission Impossible, the sort of soundless heist sequence where you see Tom Cruise dangling above Rolf Saxon's William Donlow, or the amazing, you know, I'm going straight for the commercial stuff, but the amazing shootout down the Odessa Steps homage in Untouchables.
Yeah, and even
Blowout.
Yeah, or the rubbish films like Bonfire of the Vanities opens with an amazing 5-minute track.
Oh my God, yes.
Snake Eyes.
How amazing is the opening of Snake Eyes?
Mm. Yeah.
The rest of it is rubbish.
I have a soft spot for Snake Eyes.
Yeah, I know people like Cage, don't they? They're like the kind of manic Cage.
Yeah. I think it's one of those times in Cage's life, because obviously he's gone off the rails somewhat, Cage, in terms of the quality control, I would say. And Snake Eyes is by no means a great film, but it is one of those great times when you get absolutely manic Cage married with this director who was coming off Mission and had finally, I think one of the issues through De Palma's career, I always get the sense, is him butting heads with the studio, and you know he wants to do these mad, crazy things, and they won't let him. But with Snake Eyes, they were like, "Yeah, sure, yeah, go ahead. You want to do a how long opening shot for the? Yeah, of course. You want to have Nick Cage yelling, 'I am the king'? Yeah, sure, go for it. Knock yourself out. That's good fun."
Yeah. So I actually think that De Palma should direct a Marvel movie. He should do one of those action set pieces, and he'll make sense of it. That's what he should do. Big blockbusters. It's amazing to me that he
Hawkeye in a dress.
He blew it in Mission to Mars, right? Because that feels like it should have been a blockbuster and distinctly wasn't.
Yeah, maybe, but I think there's enough of a track record to give him another go, you know.
But isn't he one of those directors who, a bit like, say, John Carpenter or John Landis, who's gone off the boil a little bit? And I realise this is probably starting at a bad point of his career, but if you look at the most recent films, the output isn't great.
No.
Femme Fatale and
Passion, isn't
Passion and Redacted.
Redacted is his worst film, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it's not good. None of those will be troubling our top 10.
I doubt it.
But, you know, let's focus on the good stuff. Let's focus on why we're talking about De Palma and why he's still relevant, why people still talk about him 30, 40 years after he first burst on the scene. And it is the fact that he's a great stylist. It is the fact that he can pull off these incredible tracking shots. It is the fact that he's a bit of a, not necessarily a pioneer, but he's someone who just goes for it. He goes for split screen. He uses
split diopter.
There we go.
Yes.
There we go. Nick.
I love saying that.
Nick threatened us with physical violence if anyone else used the words split diopter before him.
My favourite split diopter is in The Untouchables, where the opera singer is singing in the foreground and Capone is in the background. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's so good.
So it's essentially keeping two things in focus at the same time.
Yeah.
So you've got something in the background, something far away and something close, and they're both... So you get two bits of information.
Yeah, you screw something on the lens that changes the focal length of the lens, but hardly half of it.
There's an amazing one in Blowout with an owl. Travolta's over recording it, and the owl is in the right near the camera, and it swivels its head around and looks at the camera.
Yeah, the owl breaks the fourth wall. It's fantastic.
What an owl.
What an owl. What a great performance. But... Yeah, so that's an in-camera effect, isn't it? Because the one in Blowout, I was watching it again in preparation for this, and I was just thinking, when the owl swivels his head and looks at the camera, that's an incredible coincidence. I mean, they must have been
they had to get through nine owls. That was the ninth one.
Why are they killing these owls for not doing it?
No, they're firing.
They're firing the owls.
Yeah, they're taking them back to the job centre.
They were never seen again, but presumably still alive.
They all have T-shirts. I worked with Brian De Palma. You should see the other guy, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah, I mean, nobody uses the camera like De Palma. It's the stuff that he does. There's another bit in Blowout where the camera is revolving around slowly around the room as Travolta is working on his tapes, which is amazing. And I don't remember seeing that in anything else.
There's stuff in Raising Cain, which I'm a big fan of, which no one else in this room is a big fan of. But just his use of the camera, his staging, his blocking, his incredible ability to mount very complicated set pieces, whether it's, again, the shootout at the end of The Untouchables, or there's an amazing shootout equally at the end of Carlito's Way.
Yeah.
There's just something about his knack for putting a great visual set piece together is maybe not second to none. I mean, obviously, we talked about Martin Scorsese on the last podcast, Spielberg, yeah, he's pretty good, isn't he?
Peyton Reed,
don't forget Brett Peyton Ratner, all good. But he's definitely up there.
I think, if you had a top 10 of De Palma set pieces, I might be boring and go for the prom scene in Carrie.
Bucket of Blood.
Which is just amazing. Just so tense and so visual. And
the ability to do split screen and to have action sustained in split screen. And no other director really does that. I can't even think, because he's a big influence on Edgar Wright, but I can't really think of many split screen moments in Edgar Wright movies.
Scott Pilgrim? There's stuff in Scott Pilgrim.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think where he brought his up split screen is at the end of Carrie, where you kind of want to feel sympathy for her. Mm-hmm. And then he uses this very kind of fake technical device. I'm not sure that's his best use of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Do you think sometimes he's more in love with technique than he is soul?
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. It's a very cold day today, and he's colder than today. He is such a cold... He's a very cold filmmaker.
Yeah.
And which is perhaps another reason why he doesn't get to do the big Hollywood blockbusters anymore. He doesn't have a warm bone in his body.
Yeah.
Because he has Untouchables, but that's provided, warmth in that is provided by Mamet's writing, I think, and he doesn't really direct it very well. It's quite sentimental, The Untouchables.
I wonder if Carlito's Way is maybe his warmest film. It's quite soulful. Yeah. You really like that character. That's quite rare. You know, you watch something like Body Double, you don't really warm to that guy at all. Cully Stisway's got like a real humanity to it, I think.
Yeah, and there's also some humanity in the late 60s films as well. Greetings and Hi Mom. You get a sense of there's human beings here. And yeah. Just...
So what changed? Did he just fall in love with technique?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's kind of Blood Sisters is the film that it kind of... He starts getting into technique in a really big way, which is kind of his rip-off of Psycho. And that's where you start seeing it's his first use of split screen, I think. It's one of his first uses of split screen.
I agree with Nick on Carlito's way. I think there's that lovely love story between Pacino and Penelope Ann Miller really underpins the film. It really gives it something. I don't think at the end of Scarface you're rooting for Tony Montana to survive because he's such a monster. But this is like a warmer, wiser version of Scarface. And I we'll talk about it in a few minutes, but I love that film. It's probably my favorite De Palma film. And every time it's one of those movies that even though it begins with the end, you know that Carlito is dying and he gets shot at the beginning by Benny Blanco from the Bronx. You root for him to get away. It's one of those movies. It's a great tragedy in that sense. You're just hoping against hope that this is the time I will stick the DVD in this time or the Blu-ray or stream it. Yeah, it's the 90s. Yeah. And this is the moment that he's going to get away, that Benny Blanco is going to miss.
Yeah, he's got great work at Pacino, hasn't he? Both in Scarface and this.
And Sean Penn. Although Sean Penn is generally good. Pacino, you can't say the same about Pacino.
Yeah, you can.
I read someone saying that Carlito's Way is the film that The Godfather Part 3 should have been, which is quite an interesting kind of comment. The older kind of gangster.
And he's so good in that. I remember seeing him for the first time and just being absolutely blown away by just the sort of operatic sweep of the whole thing as well. But there's a glorious warmth to Pacino's performance. It's one of the few late era, and by late era I mean 80s, 90s, Pacino, that it isn't just about bluster. But there's an attempt to find the guy there. But again, there's great set pieces. Yeah. If you remember the bit where he gets out of prison, he goes to find his cousin. He goes with his cousin, and it ends up being a hit job on his cousin.
Pool table scene.
The pool table scene is so good, so good. And there's so many great moments in that, and so many great performances.
Carlito is an absolute idiot, though. I mean,
well, he's
an idiot. I rewatched it recently, and it's like, come on, don't listen to your mate who's hoovering up coke constantly. He makes a terrible decision, and he kind of has it coming to him.
He doesn't have it coming
death.
To him.
He
coming
doesn't. To him. Death.
He kind of does.
Death.
It's like, choose between your girlfriend or Sean Penn, coke monster.
He tries to have his cake and eat it. He's trying to help Sean Penn out because he's a good guy. He doesn't know the extent of Sean Penn's coke-a-rama, and so therefore... He doesn't know that Sean Penn's going to try and kill the old geezer.
We've all been there, and we all made the same call. We just got away with it, Nick.
Amongst us has never agreed to break someone out from prison and then betrayed them by stoving their heads in with a canoe, with an oar. Who amongst us has never... With a canoe. I hold a canoe on me at all times, just in case, for head stoving purposes.
I think it's technically a kayak.
A kayak, sorry. So I love Carlito's Way. And yeah, I think that's one of the few examples of heart in De Palma. Ian, you mentioned that Sisters is... how did you describe it? An homage to Psycho? A rip-off of Psycho?
Let's be generous. Let's call it an homage.
Homage, okay.
It's kind of Psycho with Siamese twins.
And Obsession is his vertigo.
His vertigo, yeah.
So he's very much a student of Hitchcock. He's very much the Noel Gallagher of movies in that way. And that these movies are his remixes, shall we say.
And his late 60s, early 70s were remixes of Godard. So he started Godard, moved on to Hitchcock, and then I guess we kind of get what he is on his own.
Forged in the crucible of Godard and Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Eventually we come to Michael Caine and The Dress. So that's where it leads.
Yeah.
That's where it always leads. But what about the Hitchcock influence on De Palma? How important is that?
It's really important. I mean, I think he says that he kind of, it's a language that you learn to speak and then you kind of find your own riffs on it. And he does. It's not a slavish reinterpretation of Hitchcock. There's much more bravura than in Hitchcock, I think.
There was a famous quote from Hitchcock when he was asked about Obsession. And he was told it's a homage, and he went, more like fromage. So I don't know how impressed the Master of Suspense was about this other Master of Suspense.
Yeah, because Sister sees him work with Bernard Herrmann for the first time as well.
Yes.
And that kind of relationship nails in the point.
Is it just that the department can get away with more because it's later, like he's doing...
There's a bit of that, yeah. There's a bit of that. I think Body Double is a film that is definitely a fuck you to the MPAA. I got you. You hammered me on Dress to Kill and Scarface. Yeah. Now I'm going to show you what I can really do, and it's really violent and misogynistic.
He had kind of carte blanche at that point, didn't he? Because he was coming off Scarface, and the studio just said, "Go away and make a film." And then when he showed it to them, they were like,
"They said, Brian, you appear to have cast Craig Wasson in a major role here. What's going on?"
Yeah. And the other thing he shared with Hitchcock is his sense of, he has a sense of black humour, I think. It's very Hitchcock.
Yeah.
There's a scene in Sisters where they're cleaning up the blood and he slips on the blood. The guy falls on the blood and I think, you know, that's kind of a very Hitchcockian thing. It's kind of playfulness as well. It kind of gets overlooked sometimes in De Palma. It's quite playful.
The interesting thing about De Palma as well is that there's a bonkers side to him as well, which I think gets expressed an awful lot. Dressed to Kill is an insane film. Blowout has insane moments.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on, some of the more commercial stuff as well, which is just nuts. And last night I had the great pleasure, and I'm using air quotes galore, of watching Phantom of the Paradise for the first time.
Okay.
And Nick, I know you will defend this movie.
I mean, it's a mild defence.
Everything's different when the tape starts rolling. It was a very strong defence.
It's
hit record.
I'm watered it down a little bit. I saw it on the big screen. Edgar Wright did a series of films at Pitch House Central about a year and a half ago, and one of them was this. He absolutely loves Phantom of the Paradise, big influence on Scott Pilgrim. And, seeing it on the big screen with an enthusiastic audience, I did enjoy it more than when I watched it on my own for the first time. It is mad. It's absolutely insane. It's kind of a sort of coked up Phantom of the Opera with Paul Williams, who you would know from Baby Driver. There's a lot of energy to it. And
you sound like a teacher trying to give someone a really, really nice report card, but they haven't had the greatest of years. I thought it was terrible. I thought it was absolutely terrible.
I think if you saw it with an audience, you'd have a better time with it.
People like the Paul Williams score, don't they? They like the songs.
Yeah, I didn't like the songs either. There was very little I liked about Phantom of the Paradise.
There's a great character called Beef in it.
Yes, Gary Graham. I do like Gary Graham.
He's fun.
Yeah.
And did you know Sissy Spacek was a set decorator on that film?
She
kept having buckets of red paint falling on her head.
Yeah, wasn't it the film before Carrie as well?
It was just before Carrie.
Yeah, because I can't make that leap from Phantom of the Paradise, which is a completely insane movie and a complete original. I mean, I will say that about it. It's like nothing else you've seen. And to literally just a few months later, Carrie, which is a great horror, great stylistic sequences right from the off, possibly the greatest ending in horror movie history as well. I can't make the leap from that guy to that guy.
Is he one of those directors that's only as good as his script? If he's got good material, he'll make a good film. And if he hasn't, he can't elevate it.
Something I learned from the De Palma documentary is that the Odessa Steppe sequence in The Untouchables was actually, he made that up on the fly. That wasn't in the script originally.
David Mamet hates it, right?
Yeah, they originally wanted to do a train chase, which they weren't able to do. And so he just created that. But I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of...
Obviously, he can elevate stuff then, so...
Yeah, I just think there's a lot of scenes which, on the page, another director would do it one way, and De Palma just would make the crazy, most excessive version of it.
My favourite example of De Palma bonkersness is... I mean, that scene in Carrie, where they go in to try tuxedos.
Yes.
And for no reason whatsoever, because he's bored with it, I think, he just speeds it up. It plays like silent comedy. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, and go for it.
Yeah,
why not go for it?
It is the excess. I think that's one of that's a word that you associate with De Palma.
Yeah,
that he just goes for broke in a way that no other director would.
Yeah,
and I think you look at the Carrie remake, and Carrie's mum in that just has a heart attack. That's her death scene. And you look at the original, and it's demented. I don't think any other director would have shot it like that. Knives just keep coming. And I think there's a Garth Marenghi's episode which kind of spoofs that. But probably still isn't as insane as the original.
It's incredible. But you're right, the excess is interesting. And he commits like no other director, even when it results in a turkey. And it did result in a turkey quite often. It seems I'm a bit sad in revisiting some De Palma for this and watching some De Palma for the first time, like Phantom of the Paradise and Bonfire of the Vanities. I stumbled upon two of the worst films I've seen this year. Bonfire of the Vanities is it's one of those movies you actually you're watching and you can't quite believe that it was made. And I was thinking to myself, there must be some sort of grand De Palma butting heads against the studio here story, but there wasn't. Apparently he was given carte blanche. There was this incredible book by Tom Wolfe, and they got the rights and off he went. The only thing was that he offered the Bruce Willis role to John Cleese. John Cleese didn't want to do it. They had to rewrite it from English to American. Bruce Willis was hot at the time. They cast Bruce Willis, who is awful in the film. But that's I think the only concession he had to make. Otherwise, he produced it, he directed it, so it's all on him. And you're right, there's loads of great moments where the camera does a lot of the work.
Yeah.
But it's a bad film.
Yes.
It's a bad film. But again, that's not focus on the bad of De Palma. No. Let's focus on the good.
What do we think is the best performance in a De Palma film?
Ooh.
I think it might be Piper Laurie in Carrie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's great.
Travolta in Blowout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's amazing. I think that's maybe Travolta's best performance, actually.
Yeah.
Really sketches Jack Terry, who's he's one name away from being John Terry, isn't he?
That's what I thought.
Which would just make the film even more difficult to watch. And the interesting thing about Travolta is that was his first film after going stratospheric with Grease and Saturday Night Fever. And he chooses to go back and work again with De Palma after Carrie.
It's one of Tarantino's favourite films, Blowout. I think it's in his top three. So that may well be why he cast Travolta in Pulp Fiction. Because I think there's so much stuff Travolta did that you look at that and go, Pulp Fiction, you can't really see a through line. But Blowout, you can absolutely see a through line, I think, with those characters. But that amazing shot with the fireworks going off behind him. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, Tarantino's a huge Travolta fan, though, right? I mean, he had a Welcome Back Cotter board game that he made him play when he came round to his house.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
imagine that.
Yeah, he's a huge De Palma fan because he nicked that scene from Casualties of War for Reservoir Dogs, look into my eyes, he absolutely lifted that wholesale.
There's a music cue from Blowout, which is in Death Proof.
Yeah.
But talking about actors, John Lithgow, I think no director's got performances out of John Lithgow, like even Harry and the Hendersons. It's not quite. Raising Cain, Blowout.
Yeah. Raising Cain.
He's good in Obsession as well. He's kind of...
I mean, what do we think it is about De Palma that allows that to happen, then? Is it that he gives these people carte blanche to do what they like and go to places that they wouldn't normally go? He's just like, so I'm more bothered by what the camera's doing. You go off and create whatever character you like.
No, I think he's clearly a very, very good actress director. I mean, Sean Connery won an Oscar for working with him on The Untouchables, and you could argue, of course, that was a Lifetime Achievement Award as well, but he's so good in that film. And he gives that film, we're talking about warmth earlier on, he gives that film the emotional heart and the warmth that it needs, I think, Connery. I don't know, maybe he's just really, really good at locking in, and clearly actors like working with him. They, you know, Lithgow worked with him a number of times, Travolta worked with him twice, Pacino worked with him twice. There's
Finney's worked with him a lot of times, Garrett Graham's worked with him a lot of times.
There's just people who keep coming back again and again and again. I was going to throw in Lithgow as a thing, but I can't really look beyond Rolf Saxon as William Donlow in Mission Impossible. No one
For people who don't know as Mission Impossible as well as you, can you explain who he is?
Let me just explain. So at a certain point in Mission Impossible, Ethan Hunt and his makeshift IMF team, the International Monetary Fund, they come together and they have to infiltrate CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia.
Yes.
And they have to steal a file from a computer that is in an office that is manned by William Donlow, who is a senior CIA systems analyst played by Rolf Saxon. Rolf Saxon was an American actor who lived in the UK in the mid-90s, and I once sat opposite him on the tube on the way home, and I thought about dangling myself down from the ceiling of the tube behind him to see what he was reading, but
were you sweating?
I was sweating.
This is my thing about Mission Impossible, right? I remember that scene. I remember there's a bit in the Eurotunnel. I can't remember anything else.
I interviewed David Schneider for Death of Stalin a few weeks back.
There's a bit with a fish tank, isn't there?
Yeah. There's a bit where he goes on the internet.
That's good.
There's a bit where he goes on the internet.
Is at the front of that film? Is he in it at the front?
I mean, it seems like you remember quite a lot of this film because you keep on going. It doesn't like you're, no, you're but, slowing yeah, down. But, yeah. I mean, the film's only so long.
So what is so great about Mission Impossible? The people who love Mission Impossible, what is so great about it?
Again, I think it's applying De Palma's style and sense of orchestrating a great set piece and brings it into what could have been otherwise a fairly standard Tom Cruise actioner. So it's not just the scene with William Donlow. There's also the opening sequence where, not the opening sequence, but the sequence where Ethan's team gets wiped out. So you get Emilio Estevez in the lift. You get all that sort of stuff happening. And there's a couple of other great sequences as well. It also has a really batshit insane twist.
If you know the TV series, right?
Especially if you know the TV series, you think that Jim Phelps, the John Foyd character, he's the hero of the TV show.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, turns out to be the bad guy of the film. And that's a really batshit insane twist. I think, had it happened today, a lot of people would have been up in arms about it on Twitter. There would have been a hashtag and everything. But back in the good old days of 1996, people loved it. I lost my shit for it.
Mission Impossible has a formula that it does. That's fair to say, right? From about 4 onwards, it has a formula. So, and certainly the first two are a script which is then given an amazing director to do what they do with that material. And two, I think, is atrocious, and one is really, really good. And I think that's a lot of it is what Brian De Palma brings to it. And it feels, if you watch it back now, it feels so unlikely as a summer blockbuster somehow, given that what we're expecting today. I mean, that sequence as they break into the CIA, I mean, it's almost entirely silent.
It's very, it's very tightly controlled, especially compared to film two, which is just John Woo off the leash and just throwing stuff and it doesn't work. But I think one, for a summer blockbuster, it's really well constructed. And the fact you have the kind of the middle set pieces is silent. And so he just slows everything right down, which he does in his other films, but it's quite rare to have that in a blockbuster, I think.
Yeah.
I just love that.
I remember when the rat turns up. That's great, isn't it?
Again, using the old split diopter.
Yeah.
There you go. Rats in the foreground. No, John Reno was in the foreground. Rats in the background. Oh.
That's Rolf Saxon.
Rolf Saxon's in the toilet, puking his guts up.
Why Nick would suggest it's not proper De Palma is that there's no voyeurism. There's no split personalities. It doesn't feel coherent with his themes, does it? It's not a film about what he's interested in.
Well, that's what I was going to get onto, because obviously when you work in Untouchables, you could argue as well, is something that is a very purely commercial vehicle for him, that maybe he had a couple of stiffs, Body Double and Wise Guys, and wanted to take a movie that would be a hit and then apply his little stylistic sensibilities to it. But when you go back to pure, undistilled De Palma, which for me is Blowout, Dressed to Kill, Body Double, Obsession, and The Fury, which we haven't even talked about really.
No.
Although I think The Fury is a bit more of a, Well, I quite like it. And great score, and who doesn't like exploding heads? For me, those movies I mentioned are the ones that really are the ones where you get the exploration of some of his themes, and voyeurism is one of those themes. And you mentioned misogyny earlier on, Ian, and we'd have to say, looking back, that perhaps his treatment of women on screen is not great.
No. You think, I remember the scene from Carrie where, apart from the shower scene at the beginning, there's a scene where they're all doing their exercises on the playing field, and the camera tracks along them, and it might as well be wearing a dirty mat. It's just, it ogles them. It really does, in ways that it's very uncomfortable.
I don't think any director has had as many shower scenes, just having been rewatching some of them over the past week. These are not films to watch on the London Underground. I was watching Body Double sitting next to an elderly lady, and honestly, she was about to hit the alarm.
Maybe there's some critics who'll argue he's looking at the mechanics of voyeurism and he's deconstructing it while he's doing it, but it's hard to separate those two things.
Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. I mean, looking back on it, I mean, Carrie obviously revolves around female protagonists, sisters as well. But I don't know. I'm struggling to think of, post those films, a really strong female character. I felt watching Blowout again how much of a damsel in distress Nancy Allen is in that movie.
No.
She's there purely defenders. Passion is bad, but there are female.
But Nancy Allen in that movie exists solely to die at the end, and that's not what you want. That's not really acceptable. And obviously, the treatment of Angie Dickinson in Dressed to Kill, you could argue as well.
Yeah,
but that was kind of a Psycho riff, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much so.
But does that get you off the hook?
Is there anything on your list that would surprise me? Has anyone gone for Wise Guys? Ian, it's not on your list.
Yeah, it's just not quite as good as Goodfellas.
Number 11.
Just not quite.
Is it better than Casino?
The film that I'd like to talk about is Greetings.
Okay.
Which is his kind of Godard period. And it's a bit like a letter from 1969. It would absolutely tell you what it's like to live in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. It's about three guys who are trying to dodge the draft. And again, it's feels more human than most of his things. And De Niro's great in there. And it's very kind of loose. And it feels a bit like a home movie in some ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also it kind of deals with his obsession that he's had of his career with the Kennedy killing, which starts there and you can trace it to Blowout, which is kind of around assassinations and Chappaquiddick and all that kind of thing. If you haven't seen Greetings, see it for a young De Niro who's brilliant. It's astonishing in it. And just see it for a more fun, flexible De Palma, I think. He's very relaxed and very improvisational, and it's away from that kind of set-piece guy that we know and love.
That's one of the ones that's actually really not available in this country. It's Greetings and...
High Mom, which is a
High
sequel.
High Mom, yeah. It's not available here on
iTunes.
But it
does sound good, actually, though. So stick it at 5 in my list, I think.
Johnny has...
I think you think that was 5. Yeah, I do.
Ian's taught me around. Yeah. Just bump everything else down.
No, Obsession features on a couple of your lists.
Yes. The thing you have to say about Obsession is that all the detectives in it are named after cheeses.
Inspector Baby Bell.
Inspector Brie. Get Detective Camembert on the phone. It's like that, but subtler than that.
Amazing. Okay, that was pretty subtle. What you were doing
Detective
is pretty subtle.
Detective Camembert.
I see my name's Sola. Yeah, Gorgonzola.
Get me Gouda. Yesterday.
It's Paul Schrader having a little in-joke there.
Well, maybe that's what Hitchcock was talking about. It's not. It's more of a fromage.
Exactly.
Yeah,
he knew.
There we go.
It's great. The Obsession is great.
It is good.
That circling shot at the end, all the kind of incest that it kind of suggests, and all the kind of weirdness and wrongness about that whole thing. It's brilliant.
She's very, very good.
Genevieve Bourgeois. Mm, yeah,
she's excellent. I mean, it is a real Vertigo ripoff, but it works. It's got Anne Lithgow's great in it.
Yeah, and a great Bernard Herrmann score.
I don't think we've talked about Casualties of War.
We haven't talked about Casualties of War.
Pipped into my top 10. Is it in anyone else's?
Yeah, it's in mine.
Yeah, it's the bottom of mine.
It pipped into mine. Again, it's not... hasn't got a lot of the De Palma sort of textbook trademark themes in it, but it's really... And it's kind of been overshadowed by Platoon. I don't think many people talk about Casualties of War, but it's a really solid film. Very, very dark. Michael J. Fox is the young soldier in, and all the other soldiers basically gang rape this Vietnamese girl and then kill her. So it's not a cheerful film, but I think it's really well done. It's got some great scenes in it. There's a scene where Michael J. Fox gets trapped in a Viet Cong tunnel and his legs are kind of sticking out, and that's really well shot.
Yeah, I think it's really it's interesting to see his technique applied to something that's real and not a genre. It's not a movie. It's a proper thing that happened in the real world. Mm. So it's interesting to see him do something like that.
I remember that movie getting a lot of flack because that was one of the first times that Michael J. Fox tried to go serious.
Yeah.
And people going, Marty McFly, it doesn't work. But I like it. It's not my top 10, but I liked it. Yeah. All right, so that's Casualties of War. And we pretty much touched on everything. So I think it is now time to take it to the voting stage. So what we're going to do is, this is a new thing in the ranking. We're going to go away, put together our top 10s. I'm going to figure out the voting system. I'm going to figure out the point system. And we're going to come back with the top 10 and quickly go through it. That's what we're going to do. So, enough squabbling. Let's vote. I'm back in a few seconds. I'm just going to do some hold music.
What is going on?
I'm confused.
All right, welcome back to the ranking, the Brian De Palma episode. I am Chris Hewitt again. Literally seconds have elapsed since last you heard my voice. You know who it is, Ian Freer, Johnny Pyle, Nick Desenlian. We've all voted. We've all put together our individual top 10 Brian De Palma films. There was a bit of an outlier at the very, very last minute. We're recording this outside the Heat offices, and Boyd Hilton, who's a massive De Palma fan, gave Nick a handwritten list of his top 10 Brian De Palma films. And the list doesn't make it in, but I wonder if anything would have changed it. Number 10, so he's gone for Dress to Kill number 1, then Carrie, Blowout, The Untouchable, Scarface, Mission Impossible, Obsession, The Fury, Raising Kane, and Body Double. That's a solid list.
That's a very good list.
That's a solid list. Yes. I do wonder if it would have changed things. But forget Boyd. Not official. You guys are official. You have voted. I have your top 10. So let's go through it from 10, all right? Number 10, Casualties of War, which, as we all know, it was John C. Reilly's first film. Did you know that, Nick?
I didn't know that.
Really?
Despite saying it.
Really? Didn't know that?
Now I do.
Oh, lucky guess.
Lucky. I'm just guessing. Casualties of War. How do we feel about Casualties of War being at number 10, boys?
That feels right to me. It feels good.
Yeah? That's exactly where it belongs in the De Palma oeuvre.
Well, let's see what's in and what's out first. That's difficult to know. If, for example, say Raising Cain was above it, then that's a disaster for this list.
Is above it or below it?
Is above it.
It's above it, okay.
At number 9, Raising Cain. Did you know that?
Is that above it or below it then? What, is this a disaster?
Honestly, this list has now come completely off the rails.
I should say, in full interest of disclosure, they both have the same number of points. I don't know why I put Raising Cain
above. You think Cain should be lowered rather than raised?
So, rather than number 10, joint ninth goes to Casualties of War and Raising Cain.
I think Raising Cain does make the top 20.
Whoa!
No, it's 9, he just said.
Whoa! Well, that's
Chris,
harsh.
What's your defence of Raising Cain? How do you defend that and not Phantom of the Paradise?
Because Phantom of the Paradise is an incoherent mess that I found quite amateurish and slapdash to watch, and I didn't like any of it. Raising Cain is one of those glorious exercises in style
that's what you could say about it. It's ultra De Palma.
It's ambitious.
It's ultra De Palma, isn't it? It's so De Palma.
It is completely and utterly nutso. I really, really like Raising Cain. It has John Lithgow giving multiple performances, clearly having the time of his life, and it has one of my favourite final shots of any movie ever.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't think there was such a thing as too much Lithgow, even in Cliffhanger, but I'm sad to say De Palma does over-Lithgow.
He can't over-Lithgow.
He over-Lithgows.
No, he Lithgows for it, and I like that about him. It's good. It's a good film. It's solid. When was the last time you raised Cain?
A couple of years ago.
Well, there you go. I saw Phantom of the Paradise last night, mate, and it's bollocks. But we'll get on to that. Well, no, we won't, because it's not in the top 10. Hooray!
Oh, boo.
Because only one person voted for it, Nick Desemlian. Oh, comes in number 13. Oh, that's a shame. Number 8, Obsession by Calvin Klein. How do we feel about this?
I think it was a tad higher on my list, but 8, I'm glad it's made the top 10.
Number 7. It's Michael Caine in a dress.
It's Michael Caine. Extra.
Now, look here. I've got a dress.
I'm not afraid to use
it. I think this made
a dress to kill.
I think it made a list for that scene in the museum, that whole museum set piece.
It's an art gallery. Even De Palma calls it a museum, but it's an art gallery, isn't it?
I think that's the same thing, though, isn't it?
No, it's not the same.
It's a museum of art.
The art gallery sequence in...
This is a separate podcast.
It's so brilliantly constructed, so hats off for that for being in the list.
Do you not think it's number 7 because... It's got Michael Caine in a dress.
It's bleeding obvious he's the killer from about 10 minutes in, but it's still good.
There's even a shot where you see him and you go, that's Michael Caine in a dress. It's bleeding obvious.
It's not the most elaborate mystery, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. But it's good fun.
He's very, very good in it.
An early Keith Gordon as well, which I like.
Keith Gordon's good.
Number 6, say hello to my little friend. It's the Untouchables.
I'm surprised that's not higher. I thought that'd been
top
5.
I told you. Everyone hates Scarface, apart from me.
Yeah.
I just thought,
it was my number 4.
Yes. In fact, I should have invited it because Spielberg directed a bit of it, didn't he?
Which bit did he direct?
When they were running and shooting.
A good bit.
It's only a little bit.
Oh, at the end when they're
in the big mansion.
In the big mansion, they're running all the gangsters running shooting, and he directed that.
Why did he make it
number 1? Essentially, I forgot that. So let's make it number 1.
Why did he direct it?
Oh, because he's an old mate of De Palma's.
But there's not a reason, because obviously he directed certain bits of certain films to learn digital shooting.
Not that I'm aware of. Right. I just think it's just for fun.
There's so much good stuff in Scarface. I absolutely love it. I kind of wish I'd put it a little bit higher, to be honest. But I think it's his most iconic film.
There should be more tactical voting.
It's got the most quotable.
You know that it's not going to be that high, and you should have put it 1 just to make sure that it gets higher.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why I put Mission to Mars at number 1. Raising Cain is on the list purely because I voted for it. It was like number 7 points. Was that number 4, number 5, whatever it is on my list, which is a madness, obviously, but that's how it got
See,
in.
Chris gets it.
It wasn't tactical. It wasn't tactical.
Right, if I have to do this again,
it feels tactical in hindsight, but it wasn't tactical. I promise you. I swear on my Lithgow. So number 6, Scarface. I think, Nick, you're right. It's entirely iconic. Mm-hmm. So many great images from it as well.
All the famous lines. Say hello to my little gun. And
And where did you get those scars on your face? I love that line as well. Yeah.
And want some coke? All the great lines.
I got lots of coke. Number five, Mission Impossible.
That's a little low.
That's mental that that's above Scarface. Sorry, that's mental. What world are we living in? A bad world.
We're living in a world where Rolf Saxon has made an impression as William Donlow on the minds of the people who voted for
him. If only Scarface had ended with David Schneider turning up at the mansion and going, whoa!
So why is Mission Impossible so high then? I mean, so presumably everyone voted for Scarface, right, in their top 10?
Uh-huh, yeah.
But it just doesn't feature very highly, right? But
did you, Ian? Did you vote for Scarface?
Yeah, I think I did, yeah. Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
but it's quite low
down on the Ian's list.
Okay. I didn't vote for Mission Impossible 2, not because it's bad, but because I like other ones more.
I'm sorry, Ian. I know this is a game of opinions, but come on. No, I really like Mission Impossible. I think it's worthy. It's worthy at number five.
It does have Tom Cruise in Liverpool Street Station, doesn't it?
It does.
That's a good bit.
It does. It's really good.
I love it when Mission comes to London. It comes to London in five as well,
Mission
right?
Mission 5, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really nice.
Remind me, when's it?
The record, isn't it? The record store.
There's a record store. Then the ending's in London, right? They're outside the Tower of London at the end. Yeah,
that's right.
Wow.
It begins in London where he meets whispering Sean Harris. Hello, Ethan.
Is there London in number six as well?
Probably. I mean, they've shot here for many months. Number four. Oh, such a shame. My number one is your number four, Carlito's Way.
Carlito Brigante,
a film I deeply, deeply love. Poor Carlito. Now, how do we feel about that?
I'm happy with that, and it's quite far-reaching as well. That film, the Sean Penn character's in Grand Theft Auto Vice City,
really.
But as quite a big character, you meet a lawyer with a big permed haircut.
Mm. Amazing.
And so, I mean, its cultural reach is quite impressive.
I mean, I'll be honest, I don't think it's as good as Scarface. I just don't. I think Scarface is, yeah, I get your point. You like Carlito more than you like Tony Montana, but everything about Scarface is big and brash and memorable. And Carlito's Way is very good, but I don't think it's a film that gets talked about a lot, and I don't think it should be above Scarface.
I'm going to go and watch it. I haven't seen it for ages.
It's so good. Young John Leguizamo, young John Ortiz, Viggo Mortensen.
Viggo Mortensen's in it, yeah.
Good.
I mean, it is better than Scarface.
It's
a better film than Scarface. Scarface, you're right, is brash with big moments and an iconic poster, and it's on student walls everywhere. Mm. But Carlito's Way is the better film.
Disagree strongly.
Nobody's putting Carlito Brigante posters on their bedroom walls at university, though, sadly. And I do wonder if that's because he's trying to do the right thing rather than Tony Montana, who's a bit of a twat. Anyway, number three, Carrie.
This was my number three, so I couldn't be happier.
You couldn't be more in line with this result.
Absolutely.
I would have had it, I think it was number two on mine.
Yeah.
But happy with
it. It's a hard watch, I think. It's not one you pull out on Friday night.
Yeah, you do.
Do you?
I've only seen it on Friday night.
It's quite unpleasant.
Yeah.
I only watched Carrie 2, The Rage.
I find it quite a tough watch, but no, I think it's excellent. It's all about the bucket of blood, and the Pinot Danaggio score is amazing.
Yeah,
over the bucket of blood scene.
Sissy Spacek gives it this very kind of vulnerable presence at the heart of it, I think, and there's not a lot of that in De Palma, so you know, that's good.
So number two, Blowout.
For me, that's his best film. It's his most grown-up film. I think Pauline Kael had a nice phrase: "It's De Palma without the cackle and the glee." I think that's kind of true. It's his most serious film.
It's got sincerity.
It's about filmmaking as well, isn't it?
It's got about filmmaking. Yep. It's got great tracking shots.
It has got a mad bit where Travolta drives through a parade, though, which seems weirdly out of whack with everything else.
And amazingly, that footage was snicked and they shot it again. That whole set piece.
Really? Yeah. Was it wiped clean by John Lithgow?
threw it in a river.
Yes.
It's a magnificent ending as well.
Yeah.
I think that and The Conversation have got quite similar endings.
Yeah.
Where you've got someone who is into surveillance, who their life just falls apart at the end. But this Blowout has got this great ending where John Travolta splices the real death scream of Nancy Allen into some cheap horror film and just sits there kind of saying it's a good scream.
It's a good scream.
There's an interview by De Palma with Francis Coppola that's going around on Twitter at the moment. And Del Toro says that if you read it, you can see the exact point where De Palma gets the idea for Blowout. because they're talking about the conversation, and you can sort of almost see the light bulb go on in De Palma's head.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It's on, I think it's a website, Cinephilia and Beyond.
That's fantastic.
Kind of around on Twitter at the moment.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's a great movie about movie making as well. I guess Body Double is his other one with a hero who's in the movie industry, but it doesn't really work nearly as well.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's fascinating, the fact you kind of see him going around collecting sound effects and all this kind of the inner workings of movie making. So
there we go. So that's number two. And then number one, drum roll, fuck it. We have The Untouchables.
Terrific.
Fine. How do we feel?
I mean, it's his most sheerly entertaining film, probably.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so much fun.
Now, why is this different to Mission Impossible? Why is that not a personal De Palma film, and this one is?
Well, it's not.
It's not. But it's just a great film.
It's just a better one than,
right, okay,
than Mission Impossible.
Does it have any of his kind of stuff in it?
Yeah, it has the opening shot.
Visually it has tons, but thematically, he's not really.
Yeah.
I don't think he's very interested in Elliot Ness, and I don't think he's interested in that story.
No. Well, we already talked about how the thing that everyone remembers, which is the Odessa step sequence, is not in the script or not in Mammoth's script. You know,
Yeah.
But it's not just that moment. There are the other great moments as well. There's, you know, obviously, it's a Mammoth script, so you get such great dialogue. You know, he pulls your knife, you pull a gun, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You get the great opening shot of De Niro as Al Capone. Could have been Bob Hoskins, so close, but it ended up being De Niro.
Yeah.
You have that lovely shot. You have that great sequence where Connery's Malone gets massacred. So many great moments in this film. And, of course, one of the first real outings for Kevin Costner as a leading man, and you get that real sense of decency as well.
Yeah.
He's really good in it, and obviously Sean Connery is the showcase role because, you know, he won the Oscar and things.
Yeah.
But, like, you need, in all these films, you need a really strong anchor around there, so that allows De Niro to be Capone, and allows Sean Connery to go off and do his Oscar-winning actorly stuff. And Costner is really good in it.
But you say that it's not really, doesn't feel like a De Palma movie thematically, but I think a lot of De Palma's movies, I mean, there's even one called Obsession. They're about obsession. They're about men who are driven.
So we're saying Ness is obsessed.
Ness is obsessed.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, ultimately what it is. You know, at the end of the film, he changes his character. He crosses a line because of his obsession with Capone. And he's driven to get Capone. Blowout's about obsession. Carlito's Way, you could argue, is about obsession to an end. Scarface.
Obsession isn't about obsession, would you?
It is. It's about cheese. Yes. It's about cheese, by Camembert. Dressed to Kill is not about obsession. Yeah, of course it is. I think that in that case it does work, which is why, married to the commercial elements plus the deep personal thematic kick as well.
Are you reading the back of the DVD?
It is, yes, starring Robert De Niro, Kevin Costner, and Sean Connery in an Academy Award winning performance. It is clearly Bri De Palmerizer's best performance. Well done, everybody. You got
all
it right.
Hail Charles Martin Smith.
All hail Charles Martin Smith.
Who we saw in Cannes once at a restaurant.
We did, yeah.
Wow.
What a story.
Don't get in a lift with him. It will never end well. All right. That is it for this episode of The Ranking. Our next one will be out next month and is on I Don't Know at this point, but we'll figure it out. And we'll let you know in due course. In the meantime, thank you so much to Ian Freer.
Thank you.
To Johnny Pyle.
Thank you, mate.
To Nick Desemlian.
Goodbye.
And it is goodbye from me as well. I'm off to dangle 3 feet above the head of Rolf Saxon. He's so used to it by now. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.